There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
The heart is a blue, shoots up through the stony ground. There's no room, no space to rent in this town. You're out of luck. The reason that you had to care, the traffic is stuck, and you're not moving anywhere. You thought you found a friend to take you out of this place, someone you can lend a hand in return for grace. It's a beautiful.
A very good morning and welcome to a food special where I head to Ireland to hear about the Origin Green programme with Bord Beer, the Irish Food Board. In 2015, the United Nations introduced the Global Sustainable Development Goals, setting a roadmap for governments and industry to move towards a more sustainable future. Ireland was one of the 193 world leaders that agreed to the goals and are using them as an ongoing guide in the development of Ireland's Origin Green programme. Hear about the work being done to support the farmer, the producer, the manufacturer and the consumer in food development. You'll also hear about the work being done at the Thinking House in data compilation, innovation, food trends around the world and customer insights. Later I head to the potato fields of Keogh's Farm and find out about the varieties, the growing process and how to make a perfect potato crisp. Learning from global markets and understanding where our food comes from is all important. The UAE imports 58.4 million euros worth of Irish produce per year, including Irish dairy, prepared foods, poultry and seafood. I sat down with Andrew Mullins, Sustainability Development Manager for Origin Green, and I began by asking what the current status is for the Irish food industry.
The Irish food industry at the moment, we've had, I suppose, a period of significant growth there over the last number of years. So our exports have reached 11 billion euro at the end, as the beginning of 2017. That's a growth of 40% since 2010. So we're in a growth trajectory, but I suppose one of the key things is that we're linking that to sustainable food production. So sustainability, I suppose, is the key buzzword in the Irish food industry at the moment. I think it'll continue to be over the next number of years. So that's really where our focus is at the moment.
Beef, dairy, they're your top products, are they?
Exactly, yeah. So beef and dairy are our main enterprises, and I suppose that's linked to our agricultural system here. So in terms of our production, we have a significant amount of grassland in the country. So our agricultural land is about 80% in grassland, and that's quite significant if you compare that to other countries. So that links to, I suppose, the production of healthy livestock there with key grass growth. But we've actually seen innovation and growth in other sectors as well. Our prepared food sector doing very well in the Middle East there. We've seen growth in our beverages sector as well. I suppose there's a lot of growth in a lot of different dairies and a lot of innovation as well in our dairy sector around products as well. So it's an exciting time.
Tell me how Origin Green came about.
Yeah, so I suppose it was a response to customer demand. So before the program was launched in 2012, we actually did quite a bit of research with our key customers, again, throughout Europe and the world. And the one word that we kept hearing back was sustainability. And so we formulated our strategy over a number of years. So before the program was launched in 2012, we did about 3 to 4 years of solid research there to actually get an understanding of what people were demanding and how we could future-proof ourselves as well. So this is really where Origin Green began. And it's grown from there quite dramatically.
What does it encompass when you say sustainability? What does that mean?
Yeah, so if you think of sustainability, I suppose there's always three key pillars of sustainability. So you're talking about economic, environmental, and that social aspect as well. And we try to cover all of those aspects throughout the program. So the program is a full supply chain program in Ireland. So we're looking at the farm level, we're looking at, I suppose, the food manufacturing and processing level, but also that retail and food service level as well. So we're gathering data on a number of different areas throughout the entirety of our supply chain here in Ireland. So if you're talking about the farm level, you know, you're talking about practical measures on farm, looking at things like fertilizer usage and manure management to things like grass grazing length in terms of how long the cattle are on grass there. And that becomes very different then at the manufacturing level. You're looking at things like energy, and you're looking at waste and water and resource efficiency essentially, but you're also looking at sourcing as well. So where are our companies, I suppose, sourcing their ingredients and trying to ensure that they're sourced in a sustainable way. So that's really what it's all about there. And again, at the final rung, that retail food service level, you've different considerations as well, things like transport and refrigeration. But I suppose the key thing is that, you know, we're gathering this data on a consistent basis for our whole food industry, and with that data we can really drive improvement.
Where we come from, water is a major issue. We don't get a lot of rain. It's the opposite here, and you can see it as you fly into Dublin over this beautiful, the Emerald Isle, so green, a very different landscape to the landscape we come from in the UAE.
Yeah, of course. I suppose Ireland is renowned for its rain. There's no doubt about that. And that can be a pain to ourselves as well. But if you think of it from an agricultural perspective, it obviously has a huge benefit there. So again, that harps back to why our beef and dairy are main enterprises, because that rain gives us, I suppose, very healthy grass growth. That grass, I suppose, is a very cheap feed for our animals, and you know, that's really what helps us to sustain our industry. I suppose just because we have a lot of rain and we have a lot of grass growth, it doesn't mean that it's not an important area. So we don't experience drought or anything like that in Ireland, and we're very fortunate, I suppose, but water is still a really key resource, and we do our very best to protect it.
And clean air. You've got clean air here.
Absolutely, as well. Yeah, I suppose Ireland as a country, we haven't had a history of a heavy industry, if you will. So that's been fortuitous to us in that regard. But again, we have, I suppose, a natural landscape where we have an infrastructure of hedgerows and things like that, which sequester away a lot of that carbon as well. So we're quite fortunate. And again, having that water advantage and that clean air obviously is a real boost to the sustainable credentials of our agricultural industry.
You know, where are you at numbers wise with partnerships, relationships? How many farmers are on board, and how do they get on board with Origin Green?
I suppose in terms of farm level there, what we have about over 60,000 farmers in quality and sustainability schemes in Ireland. And then you have at company level, you're talking over 500 companies registering to participate in the programme. If you think of that in terms of our exports, to give you an idea of scale, that's about 90% of Ireland's total food and drink exports. So it's been a very large uptake in the programme in quite a short space of time. It was only launched in 2012, so you're talking about a 5-year period, but you know, there has been considerable growth there over that time. I suppose the idea now, where we're at, is, you know, we've grown to that point, we've gained the numbers, and how do we continue to innovate now? So we're doing a lot of interesting stuff there in honing in on specific areas that our companies are having difficulties with, things like packaging and stuff like that. So I suppose the point we're at now is innovating and trying to solve long-term problems in our industry.
There are workshops, online courses, there's many ways to help build awareness, education, and that's all great. We want to save the resources as much as we can for the planet, to be kind to the planet. That's all well and good, but at the end of the day, it's also about business, isn't it? It's about livelihoods. So that's part of why you're doing this, because in many ways, by being more green, we can actually be kinder to our pocket as well.
Exactly, I suppose. If you think of sustainability at a very fundamental level, you're talking about efficiency in a lot of different ways. But if you can improve your sustainability, for example, on a farm, that really can have an impact in your pocket there. So it is a key link to profitability. And I suppose for any food producer or processor as well, the more efficient you are in your production, the more money you can save. And that's really important as well. I suppose from an Origin Green and a Board BEA perspective, what we're trying to do is really build the reputation of Ireland internationally. Obviously, we produce a lot of food here, but we need to have markets where that food goes. And that's really important. And that's our job, to promote Ireland. So if we can mesh the two together, the economic sustainability, and I suppose the environmental sustainability, that's what can really have a benefit there.
So where are you exporting to?
Ireland exports to over 180 countries worldwide every year, and that's obviously very significant there. So that we're very concerned or very aware of what's going on out there. I suppose in order to facilitate that, we have a network of about 14 international offices there, and including one in Dubai, which we opened over the past number of years. And the Middle East is obviously a key growth market for the Irish food industry as well. So the best place you can be is on the ground there in these markets, and that's really important to us as well.
So I know you've worked really hard as well on certification, verification, transparency. So what can we look out for to know that that product has come, as you said, from where it says it comes from and has followed that sustainable path?
Exactly. I suppose before Origin Green was launched, Boralbia has had quality assurance schemes in place for over 20 years now, and they've really sustained our industry in that regard, because again it's really about food safety and traceability, and they're key things in any food industry. So for Irish produce there, you know we have a quality assurance logo which easily recognises the logo, and I suppose if food is produced in Ireland, it is produced to a very, I suppose, high quality, and sustainability is now a new consideration that's come in over the past number of years. So we're merging the two together, I suppose, for the benefit of all involved, really, you know.
That's where we're at today. That's what you're working on today. What is the vision for the future?
We've set our stall out. We want to be a leader in sustainable food production. So if you want to attain or maintain a leading position, you know, you have to keep innovating. So it's really all about continuous improvement. So there are a number of measures that are really the bedrock of our program. And it's about looking beyond those as well, starting to look at other areas, things like biodiversity, for example, which is having a huge impact globally. The World Wildlife Fund, I think, estimate that we've lost about 40% of biodiversity globally since the 70s. So it's a huge impact there. And I suppose those are the kind of areas we need to focus on now and continue to focus on, along with the others that we look at as well. So it's really important to keep innovating and have that level of continuous improvement with a national programme like this.
And I really love something else you've been working on as well, which is mapping farms. So you've got a real, literally an overview of what is happening there when it comes to the environment and how you can maybe utilise that environment better to be more efficient. But it's kind of interesting how the use of technology has come into the forefront of farming. So there's a lot of good and a lot of use that can be taken from technology.
Yeah, it's kind of an ironic one, because if you think about the growth, I suppose, of technology and urbanization and globalization, some would say they have been the detrimental effect on pollination and these species. But you know, you can scale that back a little bit and use technology to your advantage, which obviously has a major impact from an agricultural perspective. So if you think of something like biodiversity, what we've done in Ireland is we've done a pilot there over the last couple of years where you've got 200 farmers in our Boralbia quality assurance and sustainability schemes. We actually mapped those formally using satellite technology, and what we're able to see there through the use of an ecologist as well is you were able to map that, I suppose, the special areas of conservation on farm or the key areas of biodiversity, and once you know what they are, you can actually start to protect them and build that over a period of time. So the aim is that from next year onwards we'll start to map all the farms in the country. The pilot was a major success, and with that kind of innovation you can really start to show improvement in the long term, and that's what we're thinking long term with this program.
Thanks to Andrew Mullin, Sustainability Development Manager for Origin Green. When we come back, I head to the Thinking House to find out about food trends. I'm in Dublin with Boralbia, the Irish Food Board, finding out about their Origin Green programme and how it's helping build a more sustainable food industry. And I moved to the Thinking House, a state-of-the-art research centre. From food styling to packaging to consumer insights, locally and globally, to workshops and events to support the food producer and manufacturer, it's a think tank full of food ideas and information. I was met by David Dealey of the Consumer and Market Insight team, who shows me the packaging for Burren Smokehouse and other brands and products, and explains how they worked with the producer to connect better with the consumer.
We would have travelled with their team, understood exactly what the brand meant, and out of that we would have done some category research. So looking at competitors like Petrosian, some of the UK brands and the US brands, and I suppose we ranked them out in order. And when we were looking at it, Brigitte's brand, the Burren Smokehouse, was at about €6.36 per 100 gram versus Petrosian, which was €18.36 per 100 gram. So it was a huge difference in ranking. the packaging really wasn't selling the quality of the product that was in here. This has been served to the Queen of England. It's a really high-end product. And Brigitte really wanted to appeal to a more international consumer. So we worked with her to develop up a creative brief with her team in List Inverna. We would have showed that to consumers, gauged their reaction to it, and then out of that developed up a creative brief and worked with Studio AAD, a design agency based here in Dublin, to develop all of this, I suppose, the icon, which is actually outside their smokehouse in List Inverna. So it's something that was true to the brand. The copper, which is, I suppose, part of the whole smoking process. The waves, because it's based on the Wild Atlantic Way. And really communicating where in Ireland the brand is from, the tasting notes, the story of the brand, all of the different awards. And again, just much more appealing to an international audience. And since launching this on shelf, it's seen a 30% increase in her sales. So it has had a commercial impact on her business as well. So this is Wyeth Aluma. It's a high-end infant milk formula brand, which is sold on shelf in China. It really communicates, I suppose, the quality of the product that's gone into it, the quality checks, and the fact that it's a safe product for Chinese consumers. So it actually sells at about twice the price of the nearest competitor on shelf. And it also communicates, I suppose, brand Ireland. So it's fantastic for other producers as well. It's a kind of a rising tide.
It's the story, and of course the story is there, but we maybe never didn't acknowledge it or really think about that before.
It's articulating it, I suppose, and I suppose telling that in a way that resonates with consumers. This as well is Avonmore. It's obviously an Irish brand, but this is actually how Chinese consumers will pick it up on shelf. So it communicates the fact that it's Ireland's number one milk, the fact that we're part of the European Union, which a lot of consumers might not be aware of, I suppose, and it's obviously a good thing. And also communicates all of the quality checks that our dairy go through. Happy cows in a nice clean environment, quality team, quality checks that it goes through, and the fact that it's really an aspirational brand, I suppose. It has natural nutrition in every drop, and it really does look like an imported brand, which I suppose from their point of view is it ticks all the boxes for safety, for quality, and a number of these have won Excellence in Market Research Awards as well from the Marketing Society here in Ireland. So there are full case studies available on all of those. Up on the screen here, we're playing some packaging trends. So we did work with the value engineers in London, looking at different packs from all around the world and the different trends that are coming out to the fore. So experiential is a big trend, sustainable packaging, simplicity, on the go, new health. They're all the big trends that we see coming through, and this just plays on loop. It's supposed to inspire our clients. It's I suppose, a stimulus for fresh thinking and looking at their category differently as well. We do on the back wall, we'll have a look at that, have some products from further afield that we pick up ourselves in our travels and bring back again to act as stimulus for people to, I suppose, look at their category differently.
Some of these products will be going into the Middle East.
They will. The Burn Smokers would. Yeah, the eggs certainly do.
Yeah, Beaulieu's tea.
And then over here, this is kind of what we like to say is our international supermarket shelf. So again, we pick up these products when we're out and about on the streets, and we bring it back. And really, this is to inspire our clients to look at their own category differently. And when we're workshopping with them, they can come out here, have a look at it, and see those trends in real life. Rather than looking at a picture, they can pick the product up. I think this is from Vietnam. So six eggs compact in this little kind of nice basket. It's really premium, high-end. Then some of the other trends that are coming through, miniature is a big thing that we see. So this is coffee that you add to hot water and you have espresso coffee on the go.
In a little miniature container.
Exactly, in a little miniature container. So that's something that you just fire into your handbag or into your pocket and away you go.
So it's like those little travel shampoos you get, but it's coffee instead.
Exactly.
It's nice.
Yeah, exactly. This one as well is, so it's a coffee brewer. You open it up, fill it with hot water, pour it out, and it's a coffee brewer on the go. Two cups of specialty coffee wherever you are, out and about.
Where did you get that from?
That one is from the US. It was made, it's actually manufactured in Denmark, but we purchased it in the US. Boxed water. Sustainability is obviously a big thing for consumers, and this is obviously taking the stance that plastic is not as good for the environment as this paper packaging is. So yeah, we picked that up in a Chicago cafe. This one is from Singapore. So it's three apples sold in a kind of a giftable long box. They're from New Zealand and they're sold at a premium price, and I suppose people would pick this up and bring it to consumers' homes as a gift.
To eat. That's very interesting, I think.
It's unusual,
isn't
yeah.
it? Mm-hmm.
Experiential is a big thing that we see. So this is actually from Tokyo. So it's a carbonated water drink that you push down and releases a spray, kind of like a champagne or bubbles. So it's experiential, and that's something that we see coming through again. And this might not be something that any of our clients ever do, but it definitely gets them thinking, well, how does this apply to my category? Is there something that I can be doing to make it more interesting for my consumers?
And how creative I can get.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, exactly. Up on the screen then over here is some examples from the Lovely Packaging website. So it's a blog that kind of collates pack designs from a number of brand agencies all over the world. And we've just come up with an agreement with them to play their work on screen. And again, we update that regularly as well.
More to come from the Thinking House as we find out about what the streetscapers are saying about food across the globe and more clues to the mystery ingredient. I'm in Dublin at the Thinking House, Boardbeer's state-of-the-art research centre of excellence, learning about food trends, packaging, recipes, and you can see pictures and video links online on my special feature page at dubaii1038.com/Dubai Today. David Dealey of the Consumer and Market Insight team is showing me around the creative spaces where food producers and manufacturers can access the library, take part in workshops and focus groups, and take full advantage of the support for free to help develop their product and business. From small to large, business support is on hand.
Our clients come in here entertaining their international guests, their buyers from other markets, and that's on an ongoing basis in the evenings typically. Up on screen, we're playing some recipe videos that we would have worked with our clients to develop through our Brand Forum program. So the Brand Forum program is a program that we have that instills best practice in branding. A number of our clients are smaller food and drink brands that don't necessarily have the big budgets to compete with the bigger organizations like Unilever and Procter & Gamble. So this allows them access to that best-in-class production process. We work with Nomos. They do all of the work with Donald Skehan. We get a food stylist and a photographer in. And over the course of 3 days, 15 brands come together. They pool the costs and, I suppose, share them out and develop these videos, which are, I suppose, optimized for Instagram, Facebook. And then we also work with them to disseminate them as well. So getting them out there, making sure that people see them. So the search engine optimization piece is big. And they're all branded and they're all promoting the individual brands. People use these at trade shows and on their social channels and on their websites as well. So it's something that our clients get a lot of value out of. And again, these just play on loop. We change them up. So up on the wall, we have some of our streetscapers. So a lot of the work that we do is international, and we really want to symbolize the global reach that we do have. So through our Consumer Lifestyle Trends program, we have 60 different streetscapers based in 60 different cities spread across the whole world in every continent. So we've gone out to them on kind of a monthly basis. They update us with fresh examples of packs that they see on brands and new products that they see on shelves in their local markets. So this is just some quotes that we've synced down from some reports that we've done up with them. They're all available on our website as well. But I suppose it makes for interesting reading, and the idea that the whole world is changing. Food 2.0 is the overarching theme. But it's interesting to see the differences in, let's say, Queen in Lagos in Nigeria versus Rose in Shanghai. And then looking kind of closer to home in Italy and back overseas to, I suppose, the US and Australia as well. So it's interesting to see the differences in needs and wants from consumers all over the world.
Yeah, so you've got people in Melbourne are not so willing to compromise. We want it all when it comes to food, quality, freshness, variety. And restaurants want to tick as many of these boxes as they reasonably can. And then you've got in Lagos, Nigeria, we're looking for engaging experiences when we go out to eat, spots that offer more than just food, or perhaps multi-purpose spaces where you can work, chill, eat and dance. I like that.
Yeah, she's brilliant. I love Queen.
And so these people, how have you identified them? How have they got involved?
So they're culturally connected individuals. Typically they're journalists, they're bloggers, they're musicians. So they're out on the street all the time. They know what's going on. They're at the leading edge of, I suppose, cultural immersions, and it really is just, they're interesting people really. That's how we've identified them. So we work with the Kantar Futures. They're a London-based research agency. So these are our kind of giant iPads. So as well as the research that we would buy in through the library, we also produce a number of our own reports as well. So that's the research that Marie was saying that we can share 100% of. So these stations, our clients can come in, they can work on their own or work with us. So they can do a tailored search in here, or they can also click through and look at some of the different reports that we have. So if they're interested in yogurts in England, exploring global meat trends, consumer perceptions of Irish strawberries, aging well in baby boomers, or they want to look at a kind of more specific, the travel retail, let's say. So this looks at travel retail and what's happening, what's emerging. There was 4 discussion groups in total, and they were 2-3 hour depths, so they were quite in-depth conversations with people that we really wanted to speak to and get under their skin and understood what made them tick. And then the quantitative piece, we had some quant research done in Dublin Airport over 2 weeks, 780 traveller interviews. And the important thing to note here is that they weren't all Irish people, because it's an airport. They were typically people that were travelling all the time, so it was a good place of accessing them. So it was a mix of outgoing and returning. And as I said, focusing mainly on chocolates and fine foods from our own clients' point of view. Another one which was probably quite different is understanding millennials for better connections. So this is obviously something that our clients are definitely very interested in as well. So within the space, you can actually click through and go straight down to the rules for connecting. So we developed it out for millennial shoppers. There are 6 big headlines. So all about being healthful, make it easier for millennials to eat well, be fast, fit into fast-paced millennial living, be naughty, indulge millennials' desire for badness, or these cheat days that we hear people talking about, be a fajita, so create more opportunities for shared experiences, be beautiful, add to the millennial story for living, the Instagram, the Snapchat, be revealing, share your knowledge, divulge your secrets. Transparency is obviously a big thing for these consumers. Be generous, appreciate their custom always and forever. And we've seen lots of different brands that do that very well, the likes of Tom's, where you buy a pair of shoes and they give a pair of shoes to the less fortunate. Be virtuous, effort-free goodness for millennials. Be brave, champion their adventurous spirit, and be interested, prove you're fascinated by them. So be interested in them as a core group. And a lot of our clients would use this to inform their NPD, their communications, their strategy going forward. For them, we've also done, I'll show you over here, research with centennials as well. A lot of what we do, I suppose, is looking forward, but oftentimes it's important to look back to the past as well. So we work with the Irish Film Institute to play out some brands, so some brand ads from the 50s, 60s and 70s. So these are ads from Ireland from a number of years ago. They're all food and drink brands. So it's interesting to see kind of the differences in the stories that they're telling, but actually the principles are the exact same. The ads haven't really changed.
The production values have come on a long way, haven't they?
But the principles are the same.
The principles are the same, but it's the design and the production, isn't
it?
Exactly. And the technology, yeah.
So this is a big global piece of research that we do. We've done it since 2006, and we refresh it every 3 years as a big refresh, but on an ongoing basis every month. So it's based on 28,000 global respondents spread across the whole world in every continent. And we have 60 different streetscapers, so they're kind of out in the street playing up what exactly is happening in their markets. And how we identify them is looking at the big macro environmental global forces that are shaping people's lives. So the political, economical, social, technological, environmental and legal forces that are shaping people's lives and the decisions that they make. So I suppose to summarise, smaller household sizes, more women working, mass scale urbanisation, surge of younger populations in emerging markets, growth of older population in developed markets, greater global connectivity, rise of lifestyle diseases and changing in the middle class structures. So all of those we put together and we look at a big quantitative piece and we map out 6 key trends that people are, I suppose, using to live their lives. You can have a look at these, but it's all available publicly. But if we click through onto health and well-being, which is obviously a big focus for consumers these days, it looks at the consumer's desire to achieve a holistic approach to physical health and emotional well-being. So because we've been tracking this since 2006, health and well-being has always been there, but actually we can look at how it's changed. So in the past, it was all about physical health, helping me to be the best I can be physically, but actually how it's kind of morphed and changed is that it's bringing in more of the emotional well-being piece as well. So it's all mental and physical. There's a video that you can click through on to our streetscapers and they can, I suppose, walk you through supermarkets in their local shops, cafes, and I suppose highlighting what's going on within each of them. Each of the trends has a key takeaway for our clients to read through and I suppose take away from them what they want. And then there's also some subtrends. So say, for example, if we click through into the strength of numbers, because, as I said, we've been doing this since 2006, we can actually look to the past and how it was. So how it was in the past within strength by numbers was this individual motivation to reach personal health goals, even if part of a group. So the example being MyFitnessPal, which is an American diet tracker, which you input food and drink consumption for the app to generate personal goals, to how it currently is. So collective health focused endeavors that give a greater sense of purpose. So the Yoga and Brunch Club YBC in London are a community with shared interest. People come together and do yoga and have brunch. And then because we have all of this information, we can also try and predict how it will be in the future. So a network of physically, digitally connected individuals with shared goals and ambitious healthy living at the centre. And the example being niche specialist health pursuits like Reebok, Spartan Race. They're the ones that are kind of leading the way within this space. Within that, you can click down to look at in-market examples from around the world. I'm sure we can definitely find one from Dubai. There's lots of different examples. And I suppose the idea behind all of this is if you don't like change, you're going to like irrelevance even less. So that's the kind of the reason why we encourage the trends with our clients. And that's a quote from the retired chief of staff for the US Army.
Thanks to David Dealey of the Consumer and Market Insight team at the Thinking House. And for more information, check out my special feature online at dubaieye1038.com/Dubai Today. When I come back, it's all about the gold stuff. Yes, Kerrygold butter.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at dubaieye1038.com.
Ireland doesn't apologise for its high rainfall, as that is what produces its fine, nutritious grass, and therefore some great meat and dairy produce. You'll see on the supermarket shelves of the UAE Kerrygold butter, and I headed to the offices of Arnua to meet with marketing manager Kate Saul. Arnua is an agri-food cooperative which markets and sells dairy products on behalf of its members. Arnua from the Irish, or Nua, meaning new gold. I sit down with Kate to a homemade scone with Kerrygold butter and jam, and Kate explains what makes this butter so special.
Kerrygold Irish butter is made from the milk of grass-fed cows, and it's really the grass-fed diet that makes it so special. So these cows here in Ireland are grazing outdoors on pasture for up to 300 days a year. And it's that beautiful grass diet that gives you the rich milk that delivers a very creamy, naturally softer butter. And it's, in fact, one of the features of the butter is how golden in colour it is, and that comes from the beta-carotene in the grass. And that golden butter is what gives you the beautiful taste. And so, like you say, it's a marriage made in heaven, Irish scones and creamy Irish butter.
I believe the scones were made out from the butter as well.
Oh, that's right. So they're everywhere. It's obviously it's quite a versatile product. It's used a lot in baking and cooking, but also it's a beautiful complement to put with potatoes or scones. So it's both an accompaniment and also a key ingredient for baking.
So tell me a bit about the story behind Kerrygold.
So Kerrygold is a brand of Arnua, which is an Irish cooperative. So essentially we work on behalf of Irish farmers to export our product across the globe and tell the story of Irish farming, which is a very natural story. It's about naturally sustainable farming from family-run farms. So our farms are small. There's about 70 cows per farm, and the farms are handed down from generation to generation. So it's a lovely story about retained traditions and families that look after their animals outdoors, and then we have the joy of exporting it. And
Tom Power says here, NDC and Kerrygold Quality Milk Award winner 2016, my ethos on farm is following on with what I've learned from how my father farmed. It has to be sustainable, profitable and enjoyable. As a family farm, we would not be successful if we are missing one of those vital components. And there's a beautiful picture of Tom looking out over the beautiful green Irish fields with his cows.
Yeah, I think Irish farmers view it as a way of life. Basically, they grow up on the farm and they then take it over. Often you'll find three generations of the one family farming, and all even the labour on the farm is all family labour. So yeah, it's a labour of love.
How long has the relationship been there in the UAE? How long has Kerrygold been coming into the marketplace?
So Kerrygold has been on the shelves in the Middle East for almost a decade now. So it grew from a small base, and now we have a team on in the market in Dubai who work on behalf of the brand. And so it's an exciting market for us to be in, and we have seen it go from build from strength to strength. So long may that last.
What are we seeing? Because there's some developments, isn't there, in your packaging and some of the products that are coming in with Ornua.
I suppose as we've been on the market and as we get closer to the consumers, we establish exactly what they're looking for. They're seeking a real premium product, and they enjoy the taste, obviously, and that comes from the natural aspect. So it's to try and convey those key consumer messages to the consumers through our branding and our in-store demonstrations.
So we have zip bags, are we?
Yeah, so we're hoping to introduce some new packaging formats for our cheese over the coming months. And one exciting development will be our spreadable butter, which we will bring to the market towards the end of 2017. And that's it's a convenience product, which is key, obviously, for busy lifestyles. So we're looking forward to introducing that.
I was really interested to see that Germany is the number one for exporting the product out of Ireland. Germany is the market. Why do you think that is? Why Germany? Because they've got their own green pastures, haven't they?
They do. I suppose Germany has been a very long established market for Kerrygold. When the cooperative was first formed, it was one of the very first markets we moved into outside of the UK. So I suppose there would be great affinity between Germany and Ireland. And they have huge appetite for sustainably produced product. And so we've been there for over 40 years now. So it's our biggest market. Where Kerrygold has a leading position. We've just introduced yogurts, so we're in big expansion mode into categories outside of our traditional cheese and butter. Germany would have a natural affinity with Ireland, and Kerrygold is you'll see it on every family table. It's a key ingredient on their shopping list.
Well, I've been enjoying the scones this afternoon, and also the shortbread, which is absolutely beautiful, very delicate, melts in your mouth. We talk about food every week on the show, and people are always worried about their health and, you know, weight and things like that, and the idea that, you know, butter isn't going to be good for us. And yet all my chefs that come on the show go butter, butter, butter all the way. For people that are concerned about their health, what would you say to them?
I suppose the movement has been around moving towards natural products and less processed products in our diet. And butter is one of those products that delivers taste to your diet and to your food. And I suppose the key is everything in moderation. Butter is, you know, butter has nothing but cream in it and maybe a pinch of salt. So it's a very natural product coming from a very natural production process. And there's huge consumer demand for butter. There's a real movement away now from, like I said, processed foods, and people are more comfortable in knowing where their food is coming from. And so that's the real story that we try and tell is you know, the very natural, the natural diet of the cows, the way the minimum production process and the very few ingredients that goes into butter. So I think, yeah, I mean, we can see that consumer demand is really growing where natural products are concerned, and Kerrygold butter and cheese fall right into that category.
Check out the special feature page at dubaii1038.com/Dubai today for pictures and recipes, including the recipe for that beautiful homemade scone with Kerrygold butter. From the city, I move to the countryside, and when I come back, we hear about Keogh's potatoes and crisps and about the Spud Nav and how you can trace the potatoes from the supermarket right back to the farm and field they came from.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcast at dubaii1038.com.
Good afternoon, if you've just joined me. Today we explore some of the produce and food concepts coming from the Emerald Isle with a focus on sustainability, as we were hearing in the first hour with Bord Beer, the Irish Food Board, about the Origin Green programme. You can't be in Ireland and not talk about potatoes, so I headed out to the countryside to meet with one of the Origin Green members, Keogh's, and Tom Keogh, whose family name has been associated with farming for over 200 years, and in recent years known for their best practice of producing potatoes for the table and hand-cooked Keogh's crisps. It's a glorious day and I'm standing in a field of Maris Pipers, and I asked Tom to explain where we are and the potato growing process.
So I'll start from the beginning. I'll kind of work you through this. You're in North County Dublin now, and North County Dublin is famous for food production in Ireland. We have about, the latest stats that were done is about 64% of fruits and vegetables for Ireland are actually grown, produced or packed in North County Dublin. So it's a real powerhouse. Reasons for that are proximity to the market. So we've Dublin City on our doorstep. I can literally leave the farm here. I could be in the centre of Dublin in about 25 minutes. So the population was always beside us, which led to a big market gardening industry out here. The climate. We have a really good climate here for growing a vast range of fruits and vegetables. Believe it or not, it's actually the driest area in Ireland, which doesn't say a whole lot. We get about 27 inches of rain here a year, but it is actually the driest region of Ireland. So it kind of lends itself very well to growing potatoes and other fruits and vegetables. And the soils, you can see the soils here. We have amazing soils, really, really deep, rich soil, which is really suitable to growing potatoes. And that's why there's so many potatoes grown here. So my family, we've been farming in this area, North County Dublin, for 200 years. The earliest document we have, proof of farming here, is tax being paid to the Catholic Church by my ancestor Thomas Keogh, same name as myself. He paid that in 1832, and that's a document in the local church, so that dates back to 1832. So we're here a long time, and we've done everything over the years. It wasn't just always potatoes, it was cabbage, cauliflowers, sprouts, tomatoes were big in the 70s. So we've reinvented ourselves over and over and over again. So today we grow about 400 acres of potatoes. The field we're standing here now, this is the closest field to the actual home farm. We've a crop of Morris Piper in here, and this Morris Piper is actually grown for table potatoes. So these will be washed and packed, and they'll end up on the supermarket shelves. Of the 400 acres, about 280 acres this year is for table production. About 120 acres is for crisping. Early crisping, and that's about another, say, 10 minutes drive away from here is our early crisping farm. We also have a network of growers around the country that grow for us as well. So we've about 25 growers from County Wexford in the south, where we start with early new season potatoes. We started there last week with the new season queens, kind of a famous new season variety in Ireland. And we work right the way up through the country to even to County Donegal, where we get a lot of their Ker Pings from.
How many varieties of potatoes do you grow?
Ourselves here on the farm, you would say there's four main varieties, okay? And Rooster being number one. Rooster accounts for about 65% of consumption in Ireland, fresh potato consumption. It was a variety that was bred in Ireland in 2002. The breeder's name was Harry Keogh, worked for Chagask, no relation to ourselves, but he bred it as a variety. It was a hybrid of two varieties, one of those varieties being a Record, which was an old, very popular variety in Ireland. Rooster was launched to market and it became hugely successful for two main reasons. Number one, it loves the Irish climate and it grows extremely well here. Loves our soils, loves our rainfall, loves our temperatures. It's been tried to be grown in lots of different countries around the world and it just doesn't work. Works really well here. So that's number one. Number two, it's suitable for a lot of uses. So you can mash it, you can boil it, you can steam it, you can chip it. It does a lot of things well. It doesn't do anything really well. You know, there's set potato varieties that do other things really well, but Rooster, the person who's buying potatoes for a household can buy Rooster and know that they can use them for any use during the week. Yeah, so that's why. So that's quite popular. Morris Piper is the other variety we grow here for table on the farm, and the Morris Piper, we love it because of the flavour. It's a really difficult variety to grow. It needs a lot of water, and we don't actually get enough water here for Morris Piper at the right time of year. So we irrigate it. And the reason that this field here is all Morris Piper is because if you look behind us here, we've a river.
Yeah.
And we're irrigating for that river. We've irrigated this crop three or four times already this year. So we need water, and that's why it's here. You also see that this field is south-facing. so it's facing the sun. So it's actually an earlier field. We can get in and we can plant this field and it'll mature earlier than other fields. So Rooster, Morris Piper, they're the two table potatoes we grow. And then you'd have a myriad of other little small varieties. Golden Wonder, Kerr's Pink, Queen's, Home Guard, Premier. But they're grown in a very small way. On the processing side, so the crisping side of our business, we grow two varieties. Number one is Lady Rosetta. And Lady Rosetta is for early crisping production. The reason we grow it is because it matures really early. So we're starting to harvest next week of our new season, Lady Rosetta. But the secret to Lady Rosetta is it's one of the only varieties you can harvest from the field and you can make crisps straight away. So we can be and from next week, we will be harvesting Lady Rosetta in the morning and they'll be turned into crisps by lunchtime.
Wow.
And it's the only variety we can do it with. The other main variety we use for crisping is a variety called Lady Clare. So you have Lady Rosetta and Lady Clare. Lady Clare is a fantastic variety because it has amazing flavour. It doesn't yield well. As a potato grower, you're never going to make a fortune from growing Lady Clare. But it has really great flavour and it stores really well long time. So we would harvest our Lady Clare around the end of September. We'd start using it around October and we'd use it right through the winter months when we can't harvest from storage. So we'd use it right through the winter months into the spring and we finish up around June with Lady Clare. So they're the four main. We have about 20 trial varieties for processing on the farm here this year. And again, we're always looking for something new. There's thousands and thousands and thousands of potato varieties out there and there's new varieties being bred all the time. So it's important that we always research and have a development program coming through. So it's about 20 varieties on that. So I'll go in, we'll have a look at this crop. They're not yet mature. What we can see here, see this crop here, the flowers are on them. It's an absolute picture.
It's beautiful.
Beautiful flowers. Yeah, on this side you can see the flowers are actually starting to die off. So basically this side is just a little bit more mature on this side. So the natural growing course of a plant is that it'll grow up, it'll go into bloom with these flowers, and then the flowers will start to die off. And once the flowers start to die off, that's the plant starting to get ready for harvest. So the flowers will die off, and a lot of that energy in the leaves, that's converted back down into the tubers. Yeah, so the tubers will bulk up at this stage quite considerably. So at the moment we are about 4 weeks here away from maturity on this crop here, probably 5 to 6 weeks away from maturity on that crop there. So that will start to die off and go yellow now naturally itself, and then we will come in with a mower and we will top this crop here, and it takes about 2 weeks then for the skins to go hard on the potato and then they're ready for harvest. Yeah, so I'd say towards the end of August, I'd say third, fourth week in August, we'll start to harvest in this field. So this potato, again, Morris Piper, but as a rule of thumb in Ireland, and it's a very rough rule of thumb, but once St. Patrick's Day passes, you can plant your potatoes. And St. Patrick's Day is the 17th of March. So especially this part of the country where it's probably a little bit late, wouldn't be as early as the south of the country. After St. Patrick's Day passes, as soon as the ground dries up, we plant. Yeah, so we get St. Patrick's Day out of the way, have a little bit of a party, and then we go and we plant our potatoes. Harvest, it all depends on the variety. We would start our early crop harvest from middle of July, really. So we're on it already. This main crop potato here, again, main crop, we wouldn't start from middle to end of August. And again, it's harvest to sell. The storage harvest, which is the main harvest where you're flat out, sometimes 24/7 trying to lift a crop and get it into storage for long-term storage, that would start around mid-September, and you'd like to get everything done by the time the frost arrives towards the end of October. A variety like Morris Piper, like on a bad year you'd harvest maybe 12 to 14 ton an acre. On a good year you could harvest twice that, you could harvest 25 to 28 ton an acre. Yeah, so it all depends on the year. The year we've had, I'd say it's going to be somewhere in between. It's going to be an average year, average crop.
Yeah. So what's your biggest challenge then?
Our biggest, again, it depends. It depends on the variety. But this farm here, because this is Morris Piper for table production, the consumers buying these potatoes will buy them with their eyes. So it's very important that we get extremely good quality and clean skin finish. And that's why this crop is beside this river here. Because water with Morris Piper equals clean skin. As you can see, straight away I can see a bit of a problem here, and it's because this plant is actually at the edge of the field, it actually did not get the water from the irrigator, and this is what happens. See the little brown blemishes on the potato?
Yeah.
Yeah, that can happen from that. Yeah, so I'd say what happened here is the irrigator came down to the edge beside the river, but it didn't go far enough to meet the edge. Yeah, and that's what happened there. So you can see what happens when you don't get enough water on this variety. but taste-wise, absolutely fantastic. A crop like that, that is probably not going to visually meet a supermarket standard, that would go for processing. Yeah, so that would probably end up as mash. Yeah, as mash, or maybe, say, a boiled potato in a restaurant. That's where that would probably end up. But it's early days. We have a long way to go.
Yeah, smells good. It's the fresh smell when you're bringing out the soil.
Yeah, it's lovely. It's lovely. Well, it's nice being here on a good day.
Yeah.
You come down here, gale force winds now, and it's about -4, and you'd be thinking twice about it, yeah.
Stay with me as I leave the field and head to the storehouse and the production and distribution facility. In Ireland, finding out about Keogh's potatoes with Tom Keogh, and we move from the field to the storehouses and factory, and Tom explains more of the process from field to fork.
When we start to harvest potatoes, harvesting the field, obviously, and all the trucks, tractors, trailers, they come into this point and everything just gets weighed on the weighbridge. So everything, at that point, actually, everything is given a traceability code. And that traceability code is the same code that you'll find on our packs in the supermarket shelf. So it's done here, and that links the potatoes straight back to the field.
So you can literally know where your potatoes come from.
Exactly where they came from and what field. And that actually follows through to our, we have a SpudNav application on our website where you can take a bag of our crisps, and if you look in the bag of our crisps, we print the name of the field where the potatoes were harvested to make those crisps, and the name of the person that cooked that batch of crisps. So if you go on our SpudNav link on our website, click on the link, and you're asked to enter the name of the field. If you put in the name of the field, it brings you through to a Google Earth, and Google Earth zooms in on the field, showing you exactly where that bag of crisps was harvested from. Yeah, and then you can look at the profile of the person that actually cooked it. We have people in New York eating our crisps who can actually just do that and look at this little field in North County Dublin in Ireland where the bag of crisps came from.
Beautiful.
Works really well. Yeah, so crop comes through here. It's given away. That's our home place here. So that's where I was brought up. My father was brought up. My granddad lived there. My father still lives there today. So that's the home place. We all go in there for lunch every day for a good old fight.
How many of you are there in the family?
In the family business, there's five family members working here. So there's my father, Peter, my uncle Tony, then my brother Ross, and my cousin Derek. Yeah, so there's five of us here, and we're all kept really, really busy. When we're not busy, that's when the fight starts. Outside of that, we would have, it's quite seasonal, so I'd say between 70 and 80 employees. And that's split between farm, between fresh potato factory, and between crisping business. Yeah, it's about 70, 80 people here. It's grown considerably, yeah.
So why do you think that is? What was the turning point? What was the impetus that took you? Well, I can smell, yeah.
You can smell potatoes, yes. I suppose the growth has come from, firstly, the crisps. The crisps, that was established in 2011. As you can see, we grow the potatoes on the farm, and we're making the crisps here on the farm. So I'll bring you in there in a few minutes so we can have a look at the crisping factory. So the crisps has brought about an extra 40 people here. Outside of that, our fresh potato has grown. And the main reasons for that is mainly due to innovation. So it's new products. We've brought along new products to the market, and we've brought along marketing and branding. So we've a branded fresh product. So our branded potato sales up until the end of last year accounted for 98% of our sales, which is very unusual in fresh produce to sell that amount of volume under your own brand. Normally you'd send under a retailer's brand. So that has led to growth because it's working. It's working on a retail level, and consumers are buying the product and supporting the brand. And then we've lots of new products. You know, we launched a product called an Easy Cook Potato many years ago. And that Easy Cook Potato is a cook in the bag. So our potatoes can be put in the microwave and cooked in the bag. We send it out to the supermarkets in Dubai as well. And that product today is our biggest selling line. We also do other really interesting products. We do a selenium-enriched potato, Selena. And what we do is we just water the potato plants at the key growing stages with selenium mixed with water, and the potato plants absorb it, and you end up with a very, very high level of selenium in the potato itself. Irish population is deficient in selenium, so that product goes really well too. Yeah, so innovation, marketing, and then obviously new products through the new crispy business as well. That's led to the growth. Yeah, so in here, this is a cold store for potatoes. And my father and my uncle built this in 1992, It was one of the first cold stores built for potatoes. And it was revolutionary at the time, because what it meant was we went from a situation whereby we had potatoes were harvested in September. They were stored at ambient temperatures under straw until, you know, pretty much February, March. The spring temperatures actually would make the potatoes go off. They'd start to grow and they'd go off. So by April, May, there was almost like a little famine in Ireland every year. Everybody was waiting for the new season potatoes to arrive the end of June, start of July. Whereas with the invention of cold storage, we can store potatoes for 12 months. So it's 365 days a year supply. In a way, you don't even know. In a lot of cases, the consumer will not even notice the fact that they've moved from an old season to a new season because of the refrigeration technology here. So we just trick the potato into thinking that it's always winter. Yeah, so we keep it dark and we keep it at about 3.5 degrees, and that's it. It keeps for 12 months. And consumers need to know that, because they can do the same with their fridge. And a lot of people don't put potatoes in their fridge. If you put potatoes in your refrigerator, you can keep them in your refrigerator for 3 months. No problem. We'll do now. I'll bring you into one of the cold stores.
Now, can I just note here that we are in the dark and you've got a torch? That's the only light we have, right?
Yes. Don't worry, you're safe. This store here holds about 1,000 boxes of potatoes. Each box contains about 1.2 tons. Yeah, so there's about 1,200 tons of potatoes in here when it's full. We only started to use this store about 2 weeks ago. So this variety is Rooster. GRN grower receipt number, so that's the trace code that goes back to the pack that goes onto the supermarket shelf. Timmy Fitzgerald, that's the name of the farmer that owns the field. So we find it very difficult to recognise fields by numbers, so we always have to put the local farmer's name or something to the field, and then we put a harvest date, October 2016. Yeah, and Peter Keown Sons, that's the family biz. If you look inside here, these are Rooster, and as I said to you earlier on, Rooster is about 65% of consumption in Ireland. It's a red skin variety, and it has quite a nice yellow flesh on it, so you can see the red skin there. And then inside you'll see it's quite a yellow flesh. Yeah, but that potato has been in here since October last year, and you can see it's in perfect condition. And there's no chemicals used, that's just cold temperatures. So in Ireland, we love floury potatoes, and again, we're unique throughout the world. We love a really floury potato. And speak for an Irish person here, and I'll say what we would love is a very, very floury potato with Kerrygold butter and nothing else. A bit of salt and pepper maybe, and that's it. Yeah. And the flouriest potato you can get in Ireland is Golden Wonder. So I'd say a Golden Wonder, Kerrygold butter, salt and pepper. Happy
and so
days.
You just boiled that.
Steamed, yeah. So don't boil. No, you steam them. Boiling a potato, you lose a lot more nutrients during the boiling process, but it's also very difficult to boil a potato with really high dry matter or flariness. You can't even walk away from the pot, because it could turn to soup at any moment. You know, it just break up. Whereas by steaming the potato, that won't happen. So you can set a steamer. You can buy a steamer for 25 euro nowadays. Set it for 30 minutes and put the potatoes in, and you get beautiful. What happens with a potato is that when it naturally wants to grow again, so when the temperatures would increase and it thinks it's springtime and, oh, happy days, we're going to start growing again, what it will do is it'll start to convert its energy into growing. And that's when you start to get the skin start to go soft. You know, you feel it like a mushy, soft potato. We don't get that here because the potato thinks it's still winter. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Okay. Get out of here before we freeze.
3.5 degrees, yeah. I can feel that.
Oh. So I will bring you into next door. We have a crisping potato store, and crisping potatoes are stored completely differently. Yeah, different temperature. Store them at about 8.5 degrees.
Oh, look at that. We like a few crisps out at a barbie or at a dinner party, but I don't think I've seen that many crisps laid out. What is it?
These crisps have been rejected. So these are the crisps that are not going to make it into the bags. And in this box, there's thousands of bags of crisps. So every week we have numerous of these boxes. We load a truck with the waste crisps, and that truck goes to local cattle farms, and we feed the waste crisps to cattle. The cattle go absolutely crazy for them. Yeah. There's no flavoring on them. It's just potatoes cooked with sunflower oil. You can see this one here was a double. It's just two crisps stuck together. This one here has darkening in the edge. You see, some of them might have a little bit of softness in the centre. Like this one here has that little bit of softness in the center. We do our benchmarking, and I can stand over it and say we've the best quality crisps on the market. In order for us to maintain that, unfortunately, we have to reject a lot in order to give us that high quality. And this is what happens here. But nothing goes to waste. Everything eventually is fed to, like in the very worst case, this will go to feed cattle.
More to come from Keogh's when we learn about potatoes and crisping. Yes, the crisp making process. Origin Green is a market leader in sustainability and supporting farmers, producers and manufacturers of food coming out of Ireland, linking them to the consumer. One of the producers to have benefited from the programme and carries the Origin Green stamp is Keogh's, who along with growing and distributing a variety of potatoes locally and internationally, they also grow and cook in small batches handmade crisps, ensuring from crop to crisp in the same day. Tom Keogh is guiding me through the whole process and I'm eager to find out how to make the perfect crisp.
This is the variety Lady Clare we spoke about earlier on. Yeah, and that's the last. We've 30 boxes left here. So we will be finished by Thursday of this week. We'll be finished on last year's potatoes. And we're going to begin harvest of this year's potatoes by Wednesday. So you can see the very last, you can see we have these little buds starting to grow on the potatoes. That's just potatoes naturally starting to grow. There's nothing wrong here. What you do is you just knock the buds off and you'll make a perfect crisp. But what we like to do this time, we like to go on to the new season potatoes because the quality deteriorates gradually at this time of year. So we try to go on to the new season as early as we can. And if you feel that potato, you can feel it's actually gone a little bit soft because it's actually started to think it's going to grow again. You know that it's a lot warmer in here.
Yeah.
Yeah, we eight and a half. It's actually warm. I turned the fridges off yesterday, Sunday, so it's probably about 12 degrees now. But normally we would store the potatoes in here about 8.5 degrees. Mm. The carbohydrates in our crisping potatoes, when you store any potato, when you store it at low temperatures, like 3.5 degrees, pretty much once you go below 6 degrees, the carbohydrates start to convert to sugars. So fructose, glucose in the potato. Once that happens, it's very difficult to get back to where it was. Unfortunately, when you try to crisp a potato with higher sugar levels, you get a brown crisp. So we've all opened bags of crisps and you've seen little brown crisps in them. That's because of higher sugar levels. And that's why it's so important that the potatoes have to be kept at higher temperatures. And in order to do that, we need to move a lot of air around this building. And you'll see the potato boxes here. There's a lot more openings. And that's to allow the air move around the potatoes and try to stop bacterial spread and try to keep them fresh.
So how many varieties of crisps do you do? Flavours?
Flavours, we have 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, I think about 12.
Yeah.
I think about 12. Yeah, we just launched a new crinkle range 2 weeks ago. That's them. That's them, yeah. Yeah, they're only starting to land in shops. There's none in the Middle East yet. There's none in Dubai. There's a salt and pepper flavour, which is my new favourite. Yeah, it's absolutely gorgeous. I'll give you some bags before you go. And I'm going to tell you a little secret about making good crisps. The higher the dry matter, the less moisture in the potato. When you're cooking crisps, what you're doing is you're taking the moisture out of the slice. So the less moisture you have to take out, the less cooking time is required, the more efficient your factory is. So number one, your factory becomes more efficient. And number two, and this is really important, is that as the moisture leaves the crisp, something has to go in. And what goes in is oil. So if you have less moisture in your potato and less moisture leaving your potato, you have less oil going in, which results in a crisp with less oil content and less fat content. So our crisps are relatively quite low in fat when compared to the competition because our potatoes are just grown in this way. And in Ireland, we naturally grow our potatoes like this. It's because what the consumer palate is attuned to. So it's actually benefited us in two regards. You get great yield through your factory, but you also get a fantastic tasting crisp. And when you taste our crisp, you notice that it actually does not have that oily taste off it that you get from if you go to Spain or France and you try crisps from the continent in Europe. They're actually used to making crisps with far lower dry matter potato, and that's one of the reasons why.
They're greasy. There's a greasiness to them,
yes.
Isn't there?
Yeah, you won't get that with ours. Yeah, I'll prove it to you later on. Over here, these are actually this year's crisping potatoes that we did a test dig this morning. So this is that variety Lady Rosetta that we spoke about. It's a red variety. Yeah. And we just tested the dry matter this morning at 26%. So they're perfect, and they're going to be ready to harvest very soon. This is a variety called That actually, that's a test variety. It doesn't even have a name yet.
Whoa.
Yeah, it just has a number. And this is a variety called Taurus. And that's an older variety, Taurus. And that's it. This is the first year we've actually grown that. We've just grown that on trial. We've only have an acre plot of that, but it's actually performing very well. So we're going to use that for early production as well. Yeah.
Great.
Okie doke. Software system here that runs the business from a manufacturing point of view. So you have a quality team. We have a quality team and quality technicians that are testing the potatoes every day, testing every load that comes in. All the results are put back into here. And we have quality control done, quality control reports done and everything. So we've one delivery today. Do you sure? Yes. Okay. So we can look at the quality of the delivery. Basically, these are new season queens that came from County Wexford this morning. We can look at that, and then we can look at the full report on the defects, etc., on the potato crop. So it's very handy. Yeah, there's about 25 people working here. Potatoes are washed up this side. They're polished, quality control. Then we've all the size grading at the back, and then all the bagging machines here. So we've line A, B, C, D, and E. Line A does all the oversized baking potatoes. Most of them will go to the restaurants in Dublin City. Lines B and C, these are our main plastic bag lines, so pre-packs that you buy in the supermarket. They can do about a bag every second. Generally speaking, line B does up to 2 kilo, and line C does from 2 kilo up to about 5 kilo, 4 kilo. Then down this end of the factory, it's all paper bags. And very interesting, actually, in Ireland, we had all my time in potatoes. When we started off, it was 25 kilo bags. You could barely hold them. But the size of potato, the average size of the bag you sold has decreased every single year. And then it stopped in 2008 in the recession. When Ireland went into recession, for the first time ever, the average size of a bag of potatoes bought in Ireland actually went up because people were buying into value. Yeah, now that's completely reversed again. The downward trend continues, which is a shame because in Ireland we've had about 50% decline in fresh consumption between 2002 and 2012. Yeah, so it's been a difficult time in fresh potatoes, but listen, that's led on to lots of innovation and new products, etc., as people like us try to fight to retain market share and try to keep their business going. This box here is interesting because this is actually a box of potatoes for crisping.
Oh.
So the process starts here. So we wash our potatoes through our fresh factory. Yeah. And they're put into these boxes and they're ready to go for crisping. So you notice that the potatoes are really clean. There's not a speck of dirt or soil on them. They're perfect and they're ready for crisping. And one of the things we do is we actually do not take this skin off. We keep this skin on the potato, and you'll see that later on in the crisping factory. The process starts here. This is actually an old potato store. We used to store potatoes in here in bulk before the invention of cold storage, and wheat and barley in here as well. Where the door we walked in, that was actually a big fan that blew air through a tunnel, that blew air through the floor and up through the crop. And before the invention of cold storage, that's how crop was stored. So in 2011, summer 2011, when eventually we got around to agreeing to build a little crisping house here on the farm, this is what we said we do. We said we convert this little building, and we put this high care cube in, which is now BRC grade AA approved, which is one of the highest standards you can get in food quality, which is fantastic. And we started making crisps. I got my first little fryer from an Amish community in Pennsylvania, and we literally started with a bucket and a slicer and a little fryer in the corner of this room. So it's grown since, in 5.5 years, it's grown considerably. We're now, we're the fastest growing brand in Ireland. We export to about 14 countries, and we're employing by about 40 people now. Yeah, so it's been a big success. So the process starts here. The potatoes come through the fresh factory. They come in these boxes, like you can see here, and they're titted up and they're sent through the feed belt into the crisping factory. So at this point, the potatoes, they're inspected. Yeah, they get a visual inspection again, and we cut out any little bits of defects on the potato itself. So we don't have any little black marks in our crisps. So that's all done by hand here. From there, we go up to the distribution here. and we feed the potatoes to the batch hoppers. These are hand-cooked kettle crisps. So number one, we have a person here stirring the fryers. It's a genuine hand-cooking process. There's no machinery to do that. We have a person looking after each batch of crisps. And that's Gregor here today. Yeah. The whole kettle cooking process is basically we're replicating how crisps were cooked in the States back in the 1870s, how they started cooking crisps. Last month I was in Pennsylvania and I met with the oldest potato crisp company in the world. Small company. We actually make more crisps than they do today, and we're only on the go 5 years. They're on the go hundreds of years. Yeah, just small little family business, but they use the same machinery that I use, and it's very, very, I suppose it's a very costly way of making crisps, but it gives you a far better quality product. What you do is you can see the slices here. We have a weight of potatoes, and we're going to slice them into this fryer. So you use the weight of the potatoes, the temperature and the moisture to bring the temperature of the oil down, and that temperature drops. Then you'll hear the burners will kick in. The burners will kick in and we're trying to heat the oil back up again. And it's that recovery. So that drop and that recovery gives you that texture to a kettle crisp. And that's what we get here today. So we know the texture of a Kyo's crisp. And that's what we try to achieve here all the time. Our ingredients change. So our potatoes, they change all the time. We can get different varieties, different dry matter levels. Even if the temperature changes outside, we're changing the temperature of our fryers, or we're changing the thickness of our slices.
Kyo's is a family-run business in Ireland, and you'll see their name on the shelves of supermarkets and cafes around Dubai. They take their business very personally, as Tom Kyo demonstrates as we look around the crisping factory.
So we have three fryers. This one's called Lindsay, and Lindsay's the wife of the guy in Pennsylvania I bought my first fryer off. This one's called Emer, and Emer's my wife, and she hates the fact that she's called after a fryer. Our fryer is called after her. And the new one, we put a new one in 2 months ago, and that's called Pat or Patricia. Patricia's my grandmother. So all the names mean something. You've seen the slices slice in. Each batch, it's about 45 kilos of potatoes go in, and we get about 16, 17 kilos of crisps coming out the other end. We're cooking in a very special type of sunflower oil. Very, very high. It's minimum 85% monounsaturated, so it's a really healthy sunflower oil. Commonly used in baby food, but we use it here to cook crisps. Very expensive oil, but it gives us a very, very good flavor. Batch takes about 8 minutes, start to finish. And after those 8 minutes, the batch will leave the fryer. Once it leaves the fryer, because the latent heat is so high, the crisps are still cooking. So we can take them out early, and that gives us lower oil content as well. And we let them to continue cooking in the open air. And they'll finish off, they'll lose some moisture in the open air. From that position, the crisps go into a holding hopper where we're trying to take a batch process, which is very much stop-start, and turn it into a continuous flow. At this continuous flow, we take out the small crisps. I don't want the little small crisps. Don't want them going into our bags. So they're rejected. And again, they go to feed the happy cattle. From that point, we go into an auto sort. So at this point, we use cameras and lasers to analyze each crisp and reject it if there's anything wrong with it. After that, it goes through a human inspection. So we have people here just using human eye, best inspection available, and we just reject it manually. And then they're elevated and they go into the bagging room. We're waiting on these batches to finish. I think this one here is going to empty now any second. You can see these are the little bits that are rejected in this little bin here. You'll feel the heat. You can actually feel the heat off the crisps as they come out. We've been blessed with the quality of the potato crop for 2016 was amazing. And we've just had beautiful crisps all year because of it. And on the positive side, the crop for 2017 is looking equally as good. Yeah. So at the end of the day, you know, in a way it's kind of up to Mother Nature what your raw material is going to be like. You can only do the best you can with your ingredients. Mother Nature gives you a lot of these ingredients. So, you know, when we have good ingredients to start with, it makes this end of the job just so much easier. So if you're brave enough, you can try one of these.
Hot crisp. Oh, it's hot. Very hot. Hot, hot, hot. I'm blowing. Lovely and crispy. Lovely crunch. Beautiful. You can't get much fresher than that, really. Can you? The temperature of the oil and the amount of time that the crisps are there, does that make a difference to the quality? Or
the guys that have been at it for hundreds of years in America, and that's where I learned, they call it a scientific art form. So in other words, it's a complete contradiction. And it changes every day. It takes a long time to learn in order to make that really good crisp. It's an art form, you know, and the guys that are in there cooking that product, they've been doing that for a long time. And I learned off people that have been doing it for a long, long time. You learn through trial and error. We made lots of mistakes over the years. You know, we're at a point now where we're making a really, really good quality product. And yeah, it's selling around the world in 14 countries. So we will do everything we can to get the best ingredients, hand cook the product, season it the best we can, and use the best provenance flavorings from around Ireland to do that. So we pay a lot of money and get really great ingredients. If you look at our flavorings, you know, our salt and vinegar, our vinegar comes from Dave Llewellyn's orchard, which is literally 5 minutes away. He harvests the apples and makes the vinegar on his farm. I buy the vinegar from David. I send it to my flavorist, who sprays it into dries it into a powder. And it's that powder that we put into our seasonings. So the provenance is amazing, and the quality of the flavorings is amazing. We never go out to chemically create any type of flavor sensation. We always go and use the actual ingredient. I was amazed when I actually started making crisps. I started looking at the ingredients on crisp packets, and we were the only crisp on the market that actually contained real meat, and we were a meat flavor. Yeah, everybody else will use a combination of different flavorings to try and make up something that tastes like something. We just launched a chorizo flavor, and the trouble we had, number one, to find an Irish chorizo, which we did. We found an amazing Irish chorizo from Gubeen in Scullin, County Cork. But then to actually take that chorizo and freeze dry it and grind it into a powder and incorporate that in the seasonings. And that's what gives us the point of difference. It's the extent we go to actually get that flavor and that taste in our product. You know, so we can start with a great ingredient from our farm, which is the potatoes. But after that, we do everything we can to make sure that we get the best ingredients from everywhere. This is really cool. What we're doing here is we're actually sizing the crisps. Yeah, so this is the first, after cooking, this is what we do. The reason we do it is because we do big bags and small bags. And at a basic level, we want bigger crisps in the bigger bags, smaller crisps in the smaller bags. When you're at home and you're opening a sharing bag of crisps to have at a party, you want lots of big crisps, you know, big bite-sized crisps in your bag. So that's what we grade out here. When you open a small bag of crisps at lunchtime, you want smaller crisps. And we're achieving that here. So it's done after cooking. This is a patented machine. It's the first one in the world. We developed it with an engineering company. And we installed it in January. And it's working extremely well. But you can see, these are the larger crisps here. And the smaller crisps are in the other line. Yeah. And they're going to two separate bagging areas.
Fantastic.
Really simple concept. But it's worked so well. Worked really, really well. So from that point here, the crisps go through to the seasoning line. And what we do in the seasoning line, it's a number of things. Number one, we weigh the crisps, okay? Because, for example, they're on cheese and onion. They need to flavor at about 7.4 to about 8.2%. And in order to achieve that, you need to weigh your crisps and you need to weigh your seasoning. So that's what we're doing. And we do it as it moves, weigh crisps and weigh seasoning to achieve that exact percentage. So that every bag tastes the same. Every bag tastes the same. After that, they go into this drum where they're mixed up together. And then they go onto this weighing head where they're weighed and they're dropped down below into the baggers. They go through a metal detector, so there's no metal, which may have been picked up during the factory process. And then they're dropped into the bags. It's quite simple.
It's all a relatively simple process.
And that's
isn't
the
it?
Secret to good food, is keeping things simple. We are so compact here. And one of the huge benefits are that we're so small, those crisps are still hot going into those bags, which means that seasoning is sticking to them extremely well. A lot of other companies actually have to spray oil on the crisps again in order to get the seasoning to stick. We don't need to do that. You know, it's a very, very compact process. So you see in the crystals upstairs on the weighing head, so they're dropped down into this bagger. This is a metal detector here they pass through. You know, for any, if metal may have contaminated it in any way, that it all gets rejected. The bag is sealed around the crisps. There's a date code put on it, and we put the field name, Middleton, the variety Lady Claire, and Darren was out in the frying room cooking them, and then we put a best before. We've just launched this new branding. So this is our family brand, the Keogh brand.
Beautiful.
But we've just redone the packaging, and to do that, we didn't go to a design agency and say design us new bags. We actually went to a local artist, and we said, could you draw us new illustrations that we can incorporate onto our packaging? And that's what he did. So the local artist is Peter Donnelly. He's from Rush, County Dublin. He's very familiar with the area, and he's created little unique illustrations that we've used in every single flavour. So this one here, we have a little truck, which is my dad's old truck. He had a little old Bedford truck that he used to drive into Dublin Market every morning with the potatoes and the vegetables. That's my dad driving the truck. He's on the front of every bag. And we have the cheese and the onion, so he's bringing the cheese and onion to the factory. So it's amazing. And here, this is actually the view of Dublin from my brother's house, which is up on a hill just behind the farm here. So you can see the pigeon house chimneys. You can see all the major landmarks in Dublin from up there, from North County Dublin. This is our salt and vinegar. And on the front of the salt and vinegar pack, we have the boat. And that boat number is 132. And that's the little antique boat that we all sailed on with our father in Skerries when we were younger. We still have it today. Just we're so busy we don't have time to sail it. But that's on the front of all the salt and vinegar packs. Yeah, and again, we have all the details on the back. Yeah.
And it says on the front there, which I think is rather apt, grown with love in Ireland.
Grown with love in Ireland, yeah. That's part of the family logo. It's Keogh's grown in love with Ireland. Yeah, works really well. Works really well. Yeah, so that's the bagging. After the bagging, we check the weight of each bag. So each bag goes over this check wire, just to make sure that we have the proper weight. And from there, they're hand packed into these boxes. Yeah, we pack them by hand so that you can actually individually check each bag before it goes in the box. And from there, they go out to these pallets where they're palletized. They're given a traceability label, and then they're shipped out around the world.
Amazing.
Yeah. So you can go from potato to crisp bag in about 10 minutes. Yeah,
wow.
Start to finish.
And you said earlier how many countries again?
We're exporting to about 14. Yeah, 14 countries. Yeah, which is great. Yeah, we're not taking over any country. It's all small, niche, high end. But yeah, we're in 14. Yeah. And the Middle East, I think the Middle East is, if not our biggest, definitely our second biggest. Yeah. China, Dubai, and Germany, three biggest markets.
We like our crisps.
You do?
Thanks to Tom at Keogh's and everyone at Border Beer and The Thinking House. Next week, I head further into the Irish countryside to learn about free-range and organic egg production for spinneys with the Nest Box Company and organic beef at Lakeview Organic Farm. Check out the full journey online at dubaii1038.com/Dubai Today and click on the special features page.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at dubaii1038.com.